Welcome to Tokyo Game Life, a Tokyo-based video game podcast focusing on Nintendo and gaming culture in Japan's capital. Your host, Mono, here to bring you a slice of gaming life from Tokyo. Today, I'm joined by returning guest, Vincent from Gamer Travels Japan, to chat all about the official Pokemon Cafe right here in Tokyo. What's the best Pokemon tableware to buy? Which starter tastes the best? Do you really need to reserve a month ahead of time? We get into everything in our thorough look at this fun-themed cafe. In the game section, I chat about three hot new releases on the Switch: Mario vs. Donkey Kong, Splatoon 3 Side Order, and Balatro. And as always, we'll close out with a bit of news. Let's get right into the Pokemon Cafe with Gamer Travels Japan. Today's feature is about another culinary and video game crossover, and perhaps the biggest one in Tokyo. I'm talking about the official Pokemon Cafe in Ginza. Joining me to chat all about Eevee Curry, Gengar Floats, and more is a special guest. So guest, please introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm Vincent Ong from the Philippines. I run a personal shopping service for gamers. What I do is I go to Japan and buy stuff for Filipinos here. So I actually, at the same time, go to cafes. My store isn't always about selling, but I also share some tips about traveling for gamers at Gamer Travels Japan on Instagram.
Thanks for joining me yet again. Longtime listeners might remember you from our episode about Hunter's Bar, the Monster Hunter Cafe. So you are really the go-to guy for a video game-themed restaurant entertainment. What is it about video game restaurants that has you hooked?
I think it's the most practical. I think part of, at least you're eating something, right? It's an experience. And you don't really have the long lines that you have going to like USJ or Disneyland, right?
Right.
And you're still within the city. So I think that's what I like about it. It's a practical experience as an adult. Like you feel, although, yeah, a bit pricey. It's one, it's Instagrammable. You can take a lot of pictures and you get a lot of freebies, as we talked about, I think, in the Monster Bar as well.
Well, today we are taking a peek at the Pokemon Cafe, which is an official permanent cafe showcasing the Pokemon brand. There's actually two, one in Tokyo and one in Osaka, but today we will be focusing on the Tokyo one. Have you been to the Osaka location, though?
Actually, I went to the Osaka location when we had Scarlet Violet launch.
So, oh, really?
Yeah, I planned a trip around the Pokemon launch of Scarlet Violet. Why I'm hooked going to cafes is when you have a game launch, you can celebrate in the cafe. It's not you just buying the game itself. You have actually something happening as well.
You've been to both the Tokyo and Osaka locations, correct?
Yeah. Osaka is actually much smaller and there are no windows. It's within a mall right beside the Pokemon Center. And that's what makes the one in Nihonbashi much better, in my opinion, because you actually have wide windows.
Right. And this is Tokyo Game Life, so we can just ignore the Osaka location. It's okay. Right. And I thought both were pretty much carbon copies, but you're saying that, oh, the Tokyo one is much better.
Yeah.
And the Tokyo location, it opened up in March 2018, and it's mostly handled by a company called SLD, which runs other restaurants in Japan, probably most famously Kawada. And it opened alongside Pokemon Center DX in Ginza around the Nipponbashi area.
Yeah.
And at the time, I believe it was the biggest Pokemon Center in Tokyo. But after they redid the Ikebukuro shop and opened up the Shibuya one, maybe it's not. But the dual opening of the cafe and the DX Pokemon Center was a major step in expanding and updating Pokemon Centers in Tokyo. And before we get to the cafe, are you a big Pokemon fan by any chance? I know a lot of your followers ask you to check out Pokemon stuff when you go to Japan.
Yes, but of course, it's funny when you have over now 1,000 Pokemon and people ask you to look for a specific one beyond Generation 2, right? And then you start looking, you need to look at your Pokedex. But I did play the DLC. So recently also, the Scarlet Violet DLC. Going back to what you said, the Pokemon Ginza shop is my favorite one in Tokyo because the Shibuya Pokemon Center is too busy. And at least there's like a dedicated elevator going to the Ginza shop. And I think it's still bigger for me than the one in Shibuya. And so you get less tourists there. So if you're looking for Pokemon goods, you most likely will find it in the Pokemon Ginza one because not a lot. Most tourists will go to Shibuya. They'll hit two birds with one stone. They'll go to Shibuya and take pictures in the crossing and then go to the Nintendo store and Pokemon
Center. Right.
Yeah.
What was your initial impression the first time you visited the Tokyo Pokemon Cafe?
I was just really amazed as a Pokemon fan, basically because it has wide windows. It had this really homey feel to it. Like, you know, it didn't feel constrictive. And of course, the first time I went to the Ginza shop also. So yeah, I was just geeking out with a big Snorlax, right? The Ginza shop also has a display of Pokemon across the years. It's a huge display. So that's why... and it's my first trip to Japan by myself. So I was like,
oh, wow.
Astonished by the experience. And that's why I'm actually nostalgic about it. I was there January 2020. So that was right before the pandemic hit. When I went to Osaka, there were COVID restrictions. Pikachu couldn't go beside you. In the Pokemon Center in Tokyo at that time, before COVID, Pikachu could actually be beside you. And I have a video on my Instagram page, and you can shake his hand. When I went to Osaka, there were still COVID rules. And so Pikachu just had to stay in front and dance. And so that was very unfortunate at that time. But actually, my cousin went to Tokyo for the Taylor Swift concert. Yes. And I saw in the Pokemon Cafe Tokyo. Now, I think Gengar is the mascot that goes around. And he can actually go around now. So I think restrictions have been lifted.
Okay, take us on a tour inside the cafe. Now, this might seem crazy, but actually, I have never been to the Pokemon Cafe due to the difficulty of getting in, which we can talk about later. So when you step into the Pokemon Cafe, what immediately catches your eye?
Both Pokemon cafes have a little display of their seasonal goods, so their seasonal merch. So usually, that's another thing why Pokemon Cafe is quite addicting to go back to, because they change their menu from time to time. And then with that comes merch. The last year was more Chinese-looking merch, like rice bowls that were red. So they were promoting that. And you actually, it's funny, it's actually good that you did enter, because there is this area where you can buy the merchandise. You don't need to eat there. You can buy the plates and whatnot. So I've actually sold some merchandise for my shoppers. And then you see a big cashier over there, because they actually put a huge wall in the Tokyo Cafe because they don't want you taking pictures of the show. But for a Pokemon Cafe, you can only stay there for an hour and a half. So basically, when you enter, you have to be there on time, and then Pikachu will come out, or the Gengar will come out, and then you can order what you want. But at most, by 90 minutes, you have to leave, because the next batch of customers will come in. They have this like big garden, you could say, rack for their merchandise to hide the tables and hide the dolls that you will see inside once you get into the cafe. Yeah.
How would you describe the overall vibe and aesthetic of the cafe? Do you feel like it captures the feeling of Pokemon?
I think it's a very welcoming vibe. The tables and chairs is like light brown. You can see there's a lot of leafy design there. They try to put plants and grass in the area. So if you played the Pokemon Cafe Mix, it basically has that kind of color scheme.
Yeah, the Kirby Cafe is somewhat similar, where it's designed almost for adults, despite it having a bunch of Kirby stuff everywhere and a lot of silly looking entrees. Why do you think both cafes have gone with this kind of targeting of older audiences in terms of the aesthetic? Like, it looks like a kind of a normal cafe, not like a playground, for example.
I think obviously because it is expensive. Like reviewing how much, actually, when I first went to the Pokemon Cafe, I just decided to buy dessert. It is too, like, this is too pricey. And it's right. Looking at reviewing it, the minimum for like food, you'll be at least spending 2,000 yen. Yeah. And that's just for dessert and drinks. Meals will probably be already, if you order a meal, it'd be 3,000 yen. So you'd probably be spending 5,000 yen if you try to have a full course meal, which I did when I did the Pokemon Scarlet launch.
All right, let's look at the food. What did you order last time you were there?
I think what's more important is that the Pokemon Cafe is very difficult to get into. You need to reserve a month in advance. And then before actually getting, I reviewed the website and see if I could reserve. It's now back to pre-pandemic levels where it's like sold out in a matter of seconds. Yesterday I checked and today I checked. And it's like people were looking and waiting exactly, I guess, 12 midnight Japan time to click the button and reserve. And when you reserve, you have the choice to buy a Pikachu keychain, like a Chef Pikachu. And for the Pokemon Scarlet set, I could order that in advance as well. So I had the Violet course, which had a Fuecoco, Sprigatito, and Quaxly on three plates. Sprigatito was like a macaroni salad, and Fuecoco was sweet potato and grilled chicken. And Quaxly was the dessert, grape and blueberry fruit. You also get a free coaster. So I think I got a Fuecoco coaster. And then you get this like D&D, what do you call it? Like paper, like wall, I guess. Like it's like a placemat. So yeah, with it as well. So you get a lot of freebies depending on what sets you get.
How would you rate the food against other themed cafe food?
I guess four. I guess for taste would be probably three or four, but presentation would be like five. I guess it's biased as a Pokemon fan. And one of the things when I first went there, I actually got Gengar clear glass. So the glass is clear and it has a face of Gengar on it. So it has this effect that Gengar is the mug or the cup, the glass itself. What's interesting about Pokemon Cafe, I ordered that and you have the option to actually buy, like if you order a Gengar smoothie with a cup, with a clear face cup, you can actually keep the cup, but you need to, of course, pay for it. I think with the others, it's also the merchandise that comes with it, and they really try to sell you with it. So yeah, like,
try to upsell.
And aside from the food, it's really the presentation. So like, I've been to Japan literally five times now, and I'm still debating whether to buy the Poltergeist and Sinistee tea set. So it's basically a teacup that looks like Sinistee and actually a teapot that's Poltergeist, but it'll cost you 5,000 yen in total.
Oh, wow.
Every time I go to the Pokemon Cafe, it gets sold out. And the last time I was there, December, they did have the full set, both the teacup and the teapot. And I was like, should I get this? And my adult side won. It's like, no, next time.
I want to look at the current menu. There's a Tatsugiri pressed sushi set, which looks like a bunch of sushi has been compressed into a block. And I've never seen anything like this before in my life. There's the Last Resort Japanese. The English names for these are often quite odd. I think they're really strangely translated, but they have very dramatic names. The Last Resort Japanese Mixed Rice Plate Meal with Eevee and Colorful Friends, which is a big scoop of brown rice in the middle, kind of shaped like Eevee. And then all the sides are the Eeveelutions. There's like eight sides. There's a yellow one for Jolteon and then a green one for Leafeon. And that one's pretty cool.
Yeah, as I mentioned, you can buy the Eevee plates.
I'm pretty sure everything they give you, you could probably technically buy as well.
By the way, with the clear mug, you'll see later when you get it, there's like a little ice cube, which is basically, it's not necessarily like, it's a light, it looks like an ice cube, but it's lighted. So it's very, so it lights up, the glass lights up as well.
On a previous episode, I talked about the Pikachu afternoon tea that had this gimmick of ice cubes is like a light. And so it flashes inside your drink, which is like a bit scary at first, but it is kind of a cool effect. Speaking of Gengar, he has his own food. He has the Gengar's Tricky Beef Stew. And there's a small pot shaped like Gengar. I don't know how to describe it. It's just like a Gengar pot. I assume beef stew is inside. And then it has some Pikachu shaped bread. And then a sweet potato sundae, I guess because Gengar's purple and the sweet potato is also kind of purple. Another cool one is the Pikachu and Best Friends Forever Curry, which has a rice Pikachu and he's sitting on curry. And then you can pick a Gen 1 starter. Bulbasaur is avocado salad. Charmander is chicken cutlet. So I guess Charmander's taste like chicken.
Yeah.
And Squirtle is seafood gratin. I guess he's a turtle, I guess. He is quote unquote seafood. So out of all these, which looks the most appealing to you?
Let's see. The Charmander, the chicken cutlet.
Okay. Yeah. And yeah, let's look at the drinks a bit. Now, I know a large part of the podcast so far has been just listing off food, but there is a lot of it. Do you think the Pokemon Cafe has a lot more food options than other themed cafes?
I think not necessarily. I mean, they have their staples, but they do change so often. So you need to keep an eye on what's coming from time to time. So I think that's what maybe their advantage is. They switch it up from time to time.
All right, back to the drinks. And you got to tell me if you tried these. You said you tried the Gengar one. That's still there, which is it's called the Gengar Confused Ray Smoothie. And I guess it's like a grape smoothie. What did you have when you ordered it? Was it a grape smoothie?
Yeah, it is a grape smoothie. It's actually a bit small. So really, you're really buying the cup.
Yeah.
It does look cool because it is very purple. It's perfect for Gengar.
Yeah, I actually broke this. I'm really sad.
Really?
Yeah, but I do still have, you'll see it. There's another menu item with a Snorlax plate. So I have that at home.
Oh, okay.
As well. Yeah.
Some of the other drinks, there's the Gen 9 Pokemon soda floats. And so it's soda and then ice cream on top. And the soda color matches the color of the Pokemon. So you've got red, green, and blue. There's the Say Hello to Eevee Royal Milk Tea, which has Eevee hiding in foam, which is like an Eevee cookie inside the foam. And I really like this one because it kind of looks like the cream is his tuft, like his chest fur, which is really fun. There's what you mentioned earlier, the Poltergeist and Sinistee's Tea Party, where the cup and the kettle are shaped like the actual Pokemon. So it is like you're kind of buying the real Pokemon.
Yeah, see. I think if I did order this, I'd probably get the set.
Yeah. And I think it's probably smaller than it looks based on the photos. There's also the Mix Allay drinks where the milk comes in a Moo Moo milk bottle, which is pretty, that's kind of a deep cut.
Yeah.
I don't know if like a lot of kids really know what is the Moo Moo milk. So out of all these, which sounds the best to you?
I'm just really biased with the tea party. Because I mean, of course, in the store, it's in the box and I only see it on a glass case. So I do want to actually hold it. Right. And then probably I'll be convinced to bring it home. If it's available, that's also another thing.
Yeah, it really does look like the Pokemon. So if you want that authentic feeling, that's definitely a good recommendation.
Yeah, yeah.
The first time I ever go, I'm definitely getting the Gengar glass because it does look really, really cool. Outside of things that you eat off of, do you have any other recommended exclusive merch that people should pick up when they're in the cafe?
The Pikachu plush. There's a red one and there's like a white one. I'm really tempted to get the black Pikachu plush. It really looks nice. Yeah, I would still like to get the teapot.
The plush is really cool because the cafe Pikachu, I don't know if he has an official name or if he's called Pikachu Chef, but there is like a special Pikachu outfit that you can really only buy at the cafe.
There's a Pikachu plate, but it's a Ditto face.
Oh, okay, cool.
Yeah.
And we mentioned it earlier about how to actually get into the cafe. So it is online reservations only. You cannot walk up there and go inside.
Yes.
I don't think they take phone call reservations either. You have to do it online. Let's say I want to go to the Pokemon Cafe. What should I do?
So best thing to go is Pokemon Center online. They have an English website, Cafe Goods. There's a little button on the website which has reservations. You choose between Osaka or Nihonbashi in Tokyo. Don't worry, there's an English version as well. It starts at like as early as 10:30 a.m. and last admission is 8:30. So you go through the form, you select how many people are reserving from the page, reservation. And as mentioned, I think the most important thing about this podcast is to reserve like a month in advance. So reservations open roughly a month in advance. I was looking yesterday, reservations for March 21 will open. But you see, up to March 20, yesterday, everyone clicked it for the whole day, like clicked the reservation. So you need to have fast fingers for the cafe. I think really, really important is that you try to wake up Japan time midnight to get that reservation.
Yeah, I definitely think that's the number one thing to emphasize. And we're not really exaggerating here. When we say a month ahead of time, we definitely mean exactly 1 month ahead of time. I also looked at the reservations yesterday, and I guess behind the scenes, yesterday was February 12th is when we're recording this, but everything up to March 13th was reserved. So it is like 30 days-ish. So don't think like, okay, it's February 12th, so I can reserve for March 12th. Not really, because it is sometimes a little, maybe a day or two off.
Yes.
So definitely check at least maybe 31 or 30-ish days ahead of time.
Yeah.
Definitely check a few days ahead because you can see which ones are sold out and which ones are the purchasing option isn't open yet. It is written there. So you can kind of get a feel about, okay, when do I need to, you know, wake up? And you really need to do it the exact second that it opens. And the way it works is that you don't just reserve and then you can go in. You need to pick the exact time.
Yeah.
For example, like 4:30 or 2:30. Yeah. So yeah, depending on when you can reserve it, if you get in at 4:30, maybe you're not hungry for like dinner. So you might have to change like what you're going to eat depending on when you get in.
The best practice is not to be too early if you're like a tourist, right? Maybe probably get an afternoon time, right? So if it's your first time in Tokyo, you probably need to figure out how to get to the Ginza shop first, right? So take time to go around Ginza, right, first. Because it's the Nihonbashi is not particularly, I guess, a touristy area, right? Would you say that?
Right.
Yeah. So
yeah,
it's not like Shibuya, which is like everyone knows how to get there.
All right. Final question. Would you recommend the Pokemon Cafe to Pokemon fans?
Oh, yes. I think we talked about the food a lot, but it's just a joy of watching Pikachu dance. And, you know, it's like I got starstruck where Pikachu actually goes beside you and you shake his hand, even for a few seconds.
Yes. Right?
It is adorable. Like, you know, this, as a longtime fan, that he actually goes up to you. That's why it's mentioned, like, it is unfortunate during 2022 when Pikachu couldn't go beside you. Now the mascots can actually, you know, you can take a picture beside the mascot. And I think they do change it up because now I'm curious because I've seen videos of Gengar as the mascot during the Pokemon show. So maybe I have another reason to go back.
Right? Exactly.
Yeah, to take a picture with Gengar.
All right, well, that was a rundown of the exciting Pokemon Cafe. So, Gamer Travels Japan, where can people find you?
So you can find me on Instagram, Gamer Travels Japan. I'll be back again in Japan this May. I actually do have to make content again. But if, I guess, for me, I just want to support this podcast because I guess we have the same goals. Just make it easier for gamers.
Awesome. So, listeners, I will link to his Instagram. So definitely check it out if you want to see what is happening in Japan. Gamer Travels Japan, once again, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. See you in Tokyo one day.
Yes. Time for some games. I've got three this time around, but let's start with Mario vs. Donkey Kong, a remake of the 2004 puzzle platformer. It's developed by NST, Nintendo Software Technology, Nintendo's internal US branch of developers. They also worked on F-Zero 99 last year, so they've had a bit of a comeback. The director of the game is Vivek Melwani, who has a pretty interesting career at Nintendo. He directed 1080 Avalanche, so he's been at the company for quite some time. He's taking over for the director of the original game, Yukimi Shimura, who doesn't seem to be at Nintendo anymore. Obviously, a lot of staff on this game are completely new. I mean, it has been 20 years. But DigiPen had a great article about how the original game's composer returned, and he also worked with the school's music department to craft a brand new jazzy soundtrack. It's a really excellent article, so find it on my socials or just Google DigiPen Mario vs. Donkey Kong. Sorry, it's hard to link things via audio. I really do wish Nintendo would break out the dev interviews again. We've had Super Mario RPG, Another Code, and now Mario vs. DK. Three fairly out-of-nowhere remakes, and Nintendo really hasn't delved into why they made them. I want to know the details about why they brought these franchises back, and specifically, why remake the first Mario vs. Donkey Kong game? Although it technically isn't the first, since Mario vs. DK is a spiritual successor to Donkey Kong on the Game Boy. The gameplay is almost exactly the same, where you traverse an obstacle-filled level, collecting items and bringing a big key to a big door. I've only played DKGB for a bit, but I really enjoyed it. Even now, the game is pretty highly regarded. But I never hear the same love for Mario vs. Donkey Kong, despite it being the de facto sequel. Are the puzzles just less interesting? Do people hate the mini Marios? I'd love to play both back-to-back to see which one is actually superior, but for now, I can only share my thoughts on the remake. Now, I've never played the original Mario vs. DK on the GBA, so I have zero nostalgia or even frame of reference for the game. Unfortunately, I can't go on a 5-minute tangent about how they changed Mario's animations and thus ruined the game forever. I'm coming at this from a completely new perspective of playing it for the first time in 2024. I rolled credits, but then the game revealed even more levels plus some expert stages, so I am probably actually about halfway through or a little bit over that. Mario vs. DK is a very pleasant, breezy puzzle platformer. Each stage has two sections, one where you bring a key to a door, and then the next stage you need to find and collect the mini Mario. Oh, by the way, the story is that Donkey Kong robbed a toy factory. Hope you're all caught up now. I do like villain Donkey Kong, and I'm definitely more of a DK arcade guy than a DK country guy. The black and red, the 80s city aesthetic with skyscrapers and brick buildings, it's just a really interesting look for Mario, and fortunately, it does show up here a bit. Also, it's just inherently fun to beat up Donkey Kong. I don't know why, but hurling a trash can at him is just hilarious. The game also has a lot of callbacks to the arcade game in terms of the music cues, which I really love. Now, it's a puzzle platformer, so you're combining your brain power with your Twitch reflexes. Though the reflexes aren't as important here, since Mario is purposefully stiff. This isn't Odyssey Mario in terms of smoothness. His movement feels a bit chunky, since it does have sort of a turn-based feel to it in terms of how you solve puzzles. You flip a switch, then move to a new area, flip another switch, use a ladder, and so on. There are some moments where you need to be quick, like dodging attacks, and most of your deaths will be due to mistimed jumps or from enemies, which have a very wide hitbox. It certainly feels like a game designed in 2004. You can feel the limitations of the Game Boy Advance, since so many of the puzzles revolve around pressing buttons that make blocks appear or disappear. I would certainly like a bit more variety in terms of the tools you use to navigate the level and solve puzzles. There are two new worlds, and these are probably the best ones, since they introduce a lot of new enemies and mechanics you don't see elsewhere, like sliding on ice. But even though the game definitely shows its age, I am having a fun time with it. It's a low-stress, often clever puzzle game with great music and some fun ideas. Mario vs. DK introduced the handstand, where Mario can block falling objects with his feet, and you can even do a higher jump exiting the handstand. There's even a triple jump you can do with handstand, then jump again once you hit the ground. Mario also has his sideways jump, which you honestly don't use that often, but the levels aren't as binary as you'd think. There are definitely moments where you can reach areas via fairly unintended ways if you time your triple jumps and use your side jump correctly. This isn't a Tears of the Kingdom level of freedom when it comes to puzzle solving, but it is fun to figure out sections of the level that reward you for utilizing your full moveset instead of just going for the obvious solution. Early on, the game is pretty easy, but there are certainly some challenging levels in the back half of the game. There haven't been any puzzles where I was just completely stuck. Since the levels are so compact and the mechanics are so few, if you try out everything in your arsenal, you will brute force a solution. But I do like the feel of a puzzle game that doesn't stress you out. It fires off some neurons, but it doesn't give you a headache. Outside of the main puzzle levels, there's a mini Mario level where you guide the little mini Marios across a stage and they collect the letters for toy, and then you need to safely guide them to the box. These are a nice diversion from the main game, but the series is somewhat infamous for focusing on this element. In the DS games and beyond, you really don't control Mario. Instead, you use the touchscreen to guide the mini Marios as if they were lemmings. I vastly prefer the Mario vs. DK structure to Lemmings, so it is odd that the series just completely shifted its genre, despite the original concept being fairly well received. The plus worlds are also kind of a mix between the two stage elements. You need to find a mini Mario that is holding a key, then guide him to the door. And it is pretty unique that they made dozens of stages with this brand new mechanic that only unlocks after you roll credits. But I do think I just prefer controlling Mario without having to worry about the minis. So, should you get Mario vs. Donkey Kong? I'm having a nice time with it, but I do wonder how much meat is on the bone. I'm done with the base story mode, and I've played for what, maybe 5 hours max? Even with the bonus levels, you could probably 100% the game in less than 10 hours. The game is a reduced $50, but man, that price isn't that reduced. It would be a much easier recommendation if it was $30, like the original GBA game. I mostly picked it up out of curiosity for the series since I've never played a Mario vs. DK game before, so if you are some sort of Nintendo hyper nerd who wants to play every single series they've put out, then it's a bit easier to recommend. For me though, I am loving Nintendo randomly putting out remakes of all the games I've missed. Super Mario RPG Remake was my first time playing through in full, I never touched another code until the remake, and now I can finally try Mario vs. Donkey Kong. And hey, Endless Ocean is also coming up, which is yet another franchise I missed. I don't know if solely catering to me is a good business strategy, but I'm not complaining. Alright, let's move on to Splatoon 3 Side Order, which is easily my most anticipated announced game of 2024. I love Splatoon 3, and I loved the Octo expansion of Splatoon 2, so yeah, needless to say, I had pretty high expectations for this piece of DLC. I'm only a few runs in, but I'm loving it, even though it's completely different from Octo, and honestly kind of a wild genre shift for the series and for Nintendo in general. Side Order is really a roguelike deck builder with Splatoon shooter mechanics. Seriously. Nintendo took a shot at the genre that is normally only reserved for indies. There aren't a whole lot of high-budget roguelikes from AAA studios in general. There's Returnal and... is that it? There are some additional modes for other games like Freelancer and Hitman, and I believe Last of Us also added a roguelike mode, but it's not a genre that too many big names have taken a stab at, despite it being a major genre in the indie space. And for Nintendo to make one, it's honestly a bit surreal, and I feel like this DLC has flown under the radar a bit. It was announced over a year ago, but we have had a long gap of silence, and then it suddenly got a release date, and now it's here. I guess Nintendo already did a big marketing push for the expansion pass last year, so if you already own that, then you own Side Order. Yet, I have to imagine there were people just waiting for Side Order before nabbing the expansion, and many who just completely forgot about the game because it was announced so early in advance. But hear ye, it's a game to put on your radar, especially if you are a Splatoon fan. One thing that immediately stuck out is that Nintendo really hid a whole lot about the game in the marketing. There are some big moments early on in the DLC that were never hinted at, and even some major gameplay mechanics that go beyond the scope of what they've shown. I won't get into heavy spoilers, but I at least need to touch on how you actually play the game. Like I said earlier, the premise is basically a Splatoon roguelike. You once again play as Agent 8 from Octo, who ends up in a stark white version of Inkopolis Square. After teaming up with a Pearl drone and meeting Oct, aka Deadfish for my Splatoon music lore heads out there, you're tasked with ascending a tower and then wiping out a bad guy at the tippy top. Each floor is a challenge stage, not too dissimilar from those found in the main story modes of the Splatoon series. Complete the task, and then you're sent up to the next floor. Each floor unlocks a color chip to add to your palette, which is basically your build. The palette is your weapon loadout, with the chips being additional power-ups. These are mostly just stat boosts, like better range or faster swim speed, or upgrades to Pearl's drone, which can also assist in battle. But there are some fun Side Order exclusive powers, like Poison Ink, which damages enemies that trudge through your ink. So that is the core loop. You go through each level, getting rewarded with a power-up, and then you try to make your way to the top. If you run out of lives, you're kicked out of the tower to try again, but your cash and chips are converted into another currency called Priz, which you then use in the main hub to alter stages or your core abilities in some way. This is where the rogue light elements come into play, since you do gradually get stronger and stronger even though you fail to run. You can also make enemies weaker, yourself stronger, or unlock guarantees like a vending machine on certain floors, which lets you bypass challenges and purchase power-ups instead. Conceptually, it's not that wild or dissimilar from the dozens of other roguelikes or lights you've played. We're going to talk about Balatro in a bit, and yes, despite it being a totally different game on the surface, they do share a lot of similar mechanics. I think what sets Side Order apart from other roguelites is obviously the fantastic gameplay mechanics of the Splatoon series, and the very strong level design. The stages are creatively designed and incorporate a lot of elements you mostly see in the multiplayer matches into a new single-player experience. There are stages where you need to push a turbine along, much like Tower Control. There's splat zone challenges, and fortunately, nothing related to Clam Blitz. The 8-ball challenges from Octo are back, but this time you can't knock the ball off the stage. Whoever made this decision should be given an award for Best Game Designer. My favorite stages are the ones where you have to KO the speedy sharks. Get close and they'll dash away, but they'll never attack. Don't try to outrun them either, because you can't. Instead, you need to be a bit clever in dealing with them. It's almost like solving a puzzle in terms of figuring out where you need to position yourself or how you can use the environment to your advantage. You can completely just blow them off the stage with a well-timed bomb or annihilate them in one shot with a special. They just look so goofy hurling to their death, and I can't help but love them. All the enemies in Side Order are completely new. They are these black and white translucent looking fish called gelatins that pour out of spawn points at an absurd rate. Not like the Salmon Run Salmonid either, which normally come out in an orderly line. The gelatins will just burst through their spawn all at once, looking disoriented. Some are pretty analogous to the salmon. You've got the little guys and the medium guys, but the way they attack and their movement is very different and much more aggressive. And man, the big whale-looking ones are both intimidating and a one-way ticket to getting kicked out of the tower. Other standout enemies are these weird top guys, where if you KO them, they leave their spinning top, which you can then knock into other enemies. There's also these bouncy enemies, which leave a spring behind, and you can just jump off of them after you've defeated them. The concept of enemies leaving behind parts, which you can then use to your advantage, is a really interesting idea. And it makes battles more frantic when you've got tops everywhere and you're just making a mad dash for a spring to get a bit more airtime. The Splatoon team deserves huge props when it comes to creating so many completely different types of enemies. We've got the Octarians, the Salmon, and now the Gelatins, all completely different in visual designs and mechanics. You could make an entire game with just one of them, but Splatoon's got three. Side Order also has its share of new bosses. They all have a degree of spectacle around them that the series is known for. There's one called Parallel Cannon, Now, I won't spoil what it is, but it's such an awesome idea for a boss with a great ending to the fight. Going back to the roguelike mechanics a bit, I think a major appeal for the genre is figuring out how to break the game, how to optimize your run or learn what builds work, or to learn what types of builds are even available. Thus far in Side Order, I haven't really felt like I'm working towards a build, though. Since many of the power-ups are stat buffs instead of game-changing mechanics, it does feel like I'm just getting gradually stronger in an overall sense, and not working towards a specific build or gameplay style. Now, I've only done 3 runs, not counting the tutorial, but I haven't felt like I've gotten absurdly stronger or had to change my playstyle because of my chips. It hasn't affected my enjoyment of the game, since the main appeal for me are the creativity of the stages and the fast-paced action, but for people who come to roguelites for the ingenuity and flexibility of character building, they might find Side Order to be a bit too straightforward or simple. Someone might say that Side Order is a good game but a bad roguelike, so get ready for that take. I could be totally wrong, though. I might pop up next episode and say, man, I created this sick Pearl Drone build that wiped the floor with everyone. You certainly do feel stronger after you unlock some of the more permanent stages to the tower via your Priz. I suppose this is just to help people who aren't super good at the game to eventually beat it, since I'm sure you could eventually just brute force your way to victory by upgrading every single thing. Nintendo wants you to beat it, and likely multiple times considering how many unlockables there are. You get keys per 10 floors, and a run has 30 floors max, so 3 keys per run at max, yet the coin locker where you use the keys has 30 or 40 things to unlock. So even if you are some Splatoon expert who clears it in just one try, there's a ton of stuff to unlock, and they are at least pushing you to keep going and getting better. I'm still trying to get to the top, though. I've done 3 real runs, and I got wiped at level 10, level 10 again, and then level 26. I think a full run would probably take about 30 or 40 minutes. Here's a tip, though. Try to avoid the rigorous danger levels. But I'm excited to keep going. Oh, I didn't mention this because by this point it's obvious, but the aesthetic and the new music tracks are all amazing. I don't think I've seen any other game look like this. It has kind of these beige, earthy tones. It reminds me of the makeup palettes with natural colors. And yes, you are using an actual palette that looks like color swatches. I don't know if this is where they are drawing their influence, but Splatoon is great about taking something unassuming and bland and adapting it to the universe in such an exciting and creative way. So, Side Order, if you are still playing Splatoon 3 in 2024, it seems like an easy slam dunk. Even if you completely fell off of the game, if you liked the single-player campaign, Octo, or you like roguelikes in general, there's a lot here to enjoy. I'll definitely give some final thoughts on a future episode when I beat it, and trust me, I will. Next run? Maybe. Speaking of roguelikes, there's one that suddenly took over the world, Balatro. It's a poker-themed roguelike from solo developer Local Thunk that's available on Switch and Steam right now. GamesRadar has a really good article about the developer, so check that out. While this is their first released game, they've also been working on others as a hobby, and hey, maybe they'll release some of the older titles now that Balatro is such a big hit. Balatro takes the core mechanics of poker and turns them into a roguelike. You make poker hands and rack up points, get enough points, and you move on to the next level. Simple as simple can be, but why is it so interesting? Because the game quickly evolves into you manipulating the rules of the game, the cards in your deck, and you go on a quest to essentially break the game by utilizing multipliers and bonuses to rack up an absurd amount of points. The real joy of the game is that there are so many things you can affect and change, so every run feels completely different, and the game is not shy about giving you absurd buffs that let you clear rounds with even the most simple of poker hands, because you've adjusted the rules so much. So your first round will be a typical poker game. Maybe you get a 2-pair, then a pair, then another 2-pair, and boom, you win the round, and you get access to the store. This is where the real fun starts. With the money you earn from each round, you can buy new cards. The highlight are the jokers, which affect the rules of the game in major ways as long as you keep them. You don't actually play them out of your deck, they sit in their own little special area and permanently affect the game as long as you have them. But you can sell them if you want. Many focus on point multipliers. So let's say you have a joker that gives you a point multiplier of 4. So if you score 100 points, that joker then adjusts it so you score 400 points. And this is the most tame basic joker you can have. This is the baby joker. Others get so specific and stupidly powerful. There's one that multiplies your points by the lowest card you have in your hand. So if the lowest card is an 8, it does an 8 times multiplier. Another adds 4 multiplier every time you play a 2-pair. Another will give you bonus cash at the end of each level. There are 150 jokers, the holy Pokemon number, and the right combo is the key to victory. My favorite, I really like the misprint, which gives you a random multiplier. It doesn't sound so amazing, but one run I was able to duplicate it. So I had two cards that potentially gave me like 60 times point multiplier each turn. Very RNG, but it's fun when you hit the jackpot. Outside of the jokers, you also have tarot cards, which change the properties of the cards in your deck, planet cards, which increase the point multipliers for certain hands, spectral cards, which give you a big buff, but often with some interesting drawback, vouchers, which give you more bonuses, like increasing your hand size or making things in the store cheaper. I don't want to spend the whole segment talking about all the mechanics the game has, but just know that the rules are basic poker, but the real fun comes from manipulating your deck in crazy ways and racking up an absurd amount of points. By the end of a run, you might just be playing all heart flushes because you have a joker that gives bonuses for heart cards, and you've leveled up your point multiplier so much, and the tarot cards allowed you to change all the suits to hearts or whatever. I mentioned that in Side Order, I didn't really feel like I was building toward a very specific playstyle, but in Balatro, you can't help but feel it, and that's really the whole game. Kind of funny because Side Order has great gameplay, but maybe the deck building mechanics aren't as in your face. Balatro's deck building mechanic is the main attraction, while the actual poker gameplay is, well, it's just poker. Nothing is particularly fun about making a full house. The joy comes from being able to do it easily because you've altered your deck and the rules so much. You don't need to be a poker fan to enjoy the game. The real fun comes from building your deck, seeing numbers pop off, and discovering new cards and abilities. The game has a nice pixel art style, and all the Joker cards have really fun designs. Some are spins on the classic clown design, but sometimes it won't have a clown at all, and instead be some sort of beautiful pixel artwork, or it'll be a credit card or a gift package. The game does have sort of a weirdly sinister feel to it, with the hypnotic swirling background and the moody music, but it's also a very chill and addictive game to play. I do wonder if I'm going to be fighting some evil Joker at the end, or if there's some sort of hidden lore I'm not catching, but I think the game is definitely helped by its distinctive and unorthodox art style. It's $15 on the eShop right now, and I think Balatro is an easy buy. If you don't like roguelikes, I do feel like this one is probably one of the easier ones to get into, since the actual game mechanics are just knowing the poker hands. There are some roguelite elements, as you do unlock more basic decks and more jokers to use in your runs, but unlike Side Order, which will probably make you very, very powerful once you get the permanent upgrades, the ones in Balatro are a bit more minor, so you really need to nail your run. If I had to lobby some criticism, the boss battles can somewhat be brutal if you get unlucky or if it completely counters your strategy. All the boss battles will have some sort of additional rule, like nullifying all your club cards or making the face cards face down when you draw them. Well, if you've been adjusting your deck to only have club cards, you're out of luck. There are ways you can re-roll the boss, but I've definitely had some runs where I was smoking each stage, but ended up on a boss that I couldn't do anything against. I kind of felt this way with Slay the Spire as well, where I felt like I did everything right, but the boss was able to hone in on my one weakness. Yet, Balatro is so fun, and runs are so quick, that even if you get creamed by a boss, that just means you want to start another run ASAP. It's truly incredible that a game like this can come out of nowhere at any time. It's awesome, but also, hey, I want to play more Mario vs. DK, more Side Order, and Unicorn Overlord is what, next week? I can't stop time to play video games, and trust me, I've tried. All right, that's it for the games. Now let's check out the news. Nintendo had its first Direct of 2024, but it wasn't like the past ones. Instead of a general 40-minute Direct, instead we got a 23-minute partner showcase showing off third-party games coming to Switch in the first half of the year. But we did have one first-party game in the mix, Endless Ocean Luminous, a brand new title in the Endless Ocean series. The dev is Arika, best known for Tetris 99, Tetris the Grandmaster, Street Fighter EX, those awesome 3D classics on 3DS, and so on. And yes, they are the original devs of both Endless Ocean titles and its spiritual predecessor, Everblue. But the publisher is indeed Nintendo. It is a Nintendo-owned IP, and it's yet another kind of under-the-radar franchise that is coming back in 2024. We had another code, Mario vs. DK, and now this. All three franchises I've completely missed, so I appreciate Nintendo helping me check these off. If you've never heard of Endless Ocean, you're a diver and you explore an ocean filled with sea creatures. It's a very laid-back, chill game that anyone can pick up and play. It's a classic Blue Ocean title, literally. The leaker Puro ignited the rumor that Endless Ocean was coming back, but I assumed it would maybe be a remaster or collection, but nope, we are getting a whole new game, and it looks quite ambitious. The standout is 30-player multiplayer, so you and a bunch of people can all dive and share discoveries together. Another thing that really caught my eye is that it doesn't really adhere to real-life nature. There are extinct and mythological animals under the ocean for you to discover. For example, in the trailer we saw a very gnarly-looking shark. I don't think the fish actually attack you, which is probably good for my stress levels, but I can imagine getting jump-scared as you swim in the dark and then a huge creature pops up. It's so great that Nintendo isn't being hesitant about reviving old franchises. One criticism you could lob at the Switch era is that they really relied on their proven franchises without creating a whole lot of new ones. What are the new Switch IPs? ARMS? Astral Chain? Ironically, Ring Fit Adventure is probably the biggest new Switch IP in terms of sales. Nintendo has mostly relied on proven moneymakers or focused on elevating franchises that were on the cusp of a breakout, like Xenoblade, Pikmin, and Kirby. But to really dig deep and say, hey, we are bringing back Endless Ocean. These games probably won't sniff a million sold, but we are dedicated to putting out quality software consistently. That's exciting for Nintendo fans. I'm really interested in Luminous, and maybe it can find a big audience since people do enjoy co-op games and cozy, chill games with minimal conflict these days. Unless a giant megalodon eats us all, then it might turn some people off. Some other big announcements, Super Monkey Ball Banana Rumble is a new Monkey Ball game hitting the Switch, also with an absurd online mode with 16 players. The remake was fun, and if this game is loaded with fun modes and a lot of levels, it should live up to expectations. We also saw Shin Megami Tensei V Vengeance, which is an enhanced version of the original game with new story elements and other additions. SMT5 was actually the first game I ever talked about on this podcast, believe it or not. I mean, it does take place in Tokyo, and you even see the iconic Yamanote line in the trailer. I enjoyed SMT5 at first, but I did fall off because it did start to get a little repetitive exploring a big empty desert over and over again. But the producers are saying that Vengeance is their original intention for 5, so if you haven't played the original, you should probably just wait for this one. And a game I'm totally going to buy, Star Wars Battlefront Classic Collection from Aspyre, a collection of the original two Battlefront games with some new features and online modes. These games rule. They are just simple, straightforward shooters with a Star Wars coat of paint and some awesome levels. It's totally worth buying just to play it launch weekend when everyone gets back into the game, and then never again. Some other big announcements, we saw a few Xbox games find their way over to Switch, like Grounded and Pentiment. Expected, considering Spencer announced earlier that the games will be hitting other platforms. Epic Mickey is also getting a remaster and or remake. So again, with Endless Ocean, the Wii days are back. There was also a bunch of other smaller stuff as well, but overall, I thought it was a solid Direct. I'm definitely getting Star Wars and Endless Ocean. Maybe Monkey Ball if it's good. If a Direct has two or more games I'm going to buy, that's good enough for me. Oh, and NSO in America is getting a couple of Rareware games, including Blast Corps, but the real NSO news is that Japan now has Mother 3 on GBA NSO. This is the second re-release of Mother 3, the first being in 2015 for the Wii U, also Japan only. The Hobonichi Mother Project did say that due to Earthbound's 30th anniversary, there will be more Mother-related events this year, but Earthbound, aka Mother 2, is 30 years old, not Mother or Mother 3, but whatever, each toy can do whatever he wants. Needless to say, a lot of people in the West are mad because it's not getting localized. And since this is now on NSO, I highly doubt Nintendo is secretly working on a remake. I would have to think eventually that Mother 2 and 3 will be remade, but we might be a decade off from that. But if you want more Mother 3 merch, Bandai will release plushies of Mother 3 characters in May. These look similar to the Mother 2 set that was recently reprinted. If it's like that set, they won't be sold individually, but instead in a set for about $100, so crack open that wallet. But I'm excited to see what other Mother events and merch we get this year, and I'll be here to tell you all about it if there are fun events right here in Tokyo. Okay, let's wrap it up. Thanks as always for listening. Be sure to like and subscribe to this podcast on your favorite app. Leave a 5-star review as well. It really helps with visibility. This podcast is also available on YouTube, so like and subscribe there as well. I am on Twitter, Threads, Blue Sky, Instagram. Just search for Tokyo Game Life or find the links in the podcast description. If you like the podcast, be sure to share it with your friends and on social media. If there's anything you want me to talk about or cover, don't be shy. Just message me on Twitter. The next episode will be on March 10th. Hey, that's Mario Day. See you next time. Matane!